This weekend, people across Scotland, Wales and most of England were forced to scale down plans for Christmas to just one day, while millions in the southeast were told they wouldn't be able to mix with anyone at all as they entered Tier 4, pretty much a full lockdown. The drastic shift in policy was in response to a new strain of COVID-19 that worryingly appears to spread much more quickly. It's the latest twist in the story of a pandemic that has swept through our lives this year, killing millions and forcing countries into lockdowns that have shattered their economies. Through the year, Today in Focus has relied on people at the heart of that crisis, from intensive care doctors and patients to care home managers, grieving relatives, or those losing their jobs, to help us tell that story. Today, we have gone back to some of them to find out what happened next in their lives.
We first heard about it on the 31st of December. It was New Year's Eve, and we were planning to go out, and it was not really a kind of like a big thing about it. And it was kind of a bit jokey, really. We just went out and we stayed out late, and we met many people, and people were mingling and hugging and drinking, things like that. Just a normal New Year's Eve. As the weeks progressed, the authorities were saying, oh yes, it's under control, you know, we're managing, it's not a problem.
Kathleen, we're hearing you speak to Rachel back in January, and it is one of the interviews of the year that really sticks in my mind, because I very vividly remember your description of the empty streets of Wuhan.
I can see a traffic junction. It's normally a very busy, it's kind of like six lanes, but, you know, I now see three cars. The pavements are deserted.
It was the first time I'd ever thought about the notion of lockdown because of a virus. Did you manage to leave?
Yes, I did. I left. I was evacuated at the end of January, beginning of February. I was evacuated with the Europeans. When we started going down the runway, that's when I kind of like felt a sense of relief. Yes, we're away.
So you've spent this year largely in Europe, moving between Airbnbs and including visiting the UK. Did you find it strange seeing the contrast with what you'd experienced in Wuhan?
That was one of the odd things, is we knew what was going to happen. And it was in Spitalfields, and it was just, you know, shoulder to shoulder. I was so surprised that nobody had a mask on and everybody was just acting as very normal. And we kind of came from somewhere where, when I left my apartment, I mean, I had plastic gloves on to press the elevator buttons. You know, it could have been anywhere. You did not touch anything. And then kind of like I come to Europe, and then Boris Johnson is on television saying he's shaking hands with people in hospital, and maybe there were COVID patients and he was going to carry on doing it. And I'm thinking, oh my God, he's introducing this to the people of England in this way. Hasn't anybody briefed him?
Even after experiencing months of lockdown in Europe, the contrast with the Chinese approach was striking when Kathleen returned in October. At the airport, she was immediately tested.
You have a COVID test right in your throat, up your nose, very, very aggressive, getting right to the top.
She was then transported to a hotel for quarantine, where she and her husband were confined to a room with five knocks on the door a day, three for meals, two for temperature checks.
We arrived at 8:25 in Wednesday evening, and we were let out at 8:25 on a Wednesday evening 2 weeks later.
So incredibly strict when you first returned to China. But what was it like when you got home to Wuhan?
As far as public transport, that's back to normal. In the streets, Wuhan's a very bubbly city. 99.9% were wearing masks. The restaurants are all full. Everybody talks at the top of their voice. If you've got somebody opposite you, you've got to scream for them to hear you. So that's why the restaurants were so noisy. I would say in that sense, Wuhan is back to normal.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, the people who helped us to tell the story of COVID-19. Laura McClelland, you're a consultant in intensive care and anaesthetics, and we spoke right at the end of March, and it was a very strange period. Everyone was in shock. The first doctors had actually died, I think, the week that we spoke, from COVID. Are the patients who you're seeing scared when they come in?
Yeah, they are. I mean, yeah, they are scared, undeniably scared. And I don't know how to reassure them, because aside telling them that they're in good hands, that they're safe, and we're going to do the very best that we can to look after them, I have no guarantees. I don't know what happens with this disease. I've not seen enough people come through it.
And you were braced for it getting really bad in your area. Can you tell me what that period was actually like?
So it was like something I've never experienced before. We were extremely, extremely busy with a cohort of very sick patients who were suffering from a disease that we had absolutely no experience of. So it was pretty scary. The workload was monumental, but then again, so was the team spirit and the effort that everybody put in and the camaraderie. So people just got on with it, and red tape was removed, stuff just got done. We were in PPE all day, every day, and I'm very proud of what we were able to achieve.
I remember you saying one of the really hard things was that family members couldn't be there.
Well, it's interesting you should say that, because that situation has evolved actually quite a lot since then. And I'm pleased to say that we now do allow families to visit at the end of life in a controlled manner. So people wear PPE. So that has all changed. But in the period where that was evolving, I had a fair few situations where I conducted end of life discussions and end of life care over FaceTime. And I'll never forget talking to a lady whose father was dying with us in the intensive care unit. And I just thought, what does she want to see? What does she want to hear at the moment? She wants to see who's looking after her dad. And she wants to see the environment he's in. She wants to see his face and see what he's going through at the moment. And so we just kind of talked through who the individual members of the team were, bearing in mind she couldn't actually see us because we had full PPE on. But we introduced ourselves, we explained what all the equipment was, we showed her that he still looked like dad and that he was comfortable and well cared for. And then we talked through the process that we were going to be going through at the end of life, and showed her the monitoring and the screens, etc., just so that she could be part of it. And that's what happened. So when we discontinued the life-sustaining treatment, she was part of that process and was talking to him throughout that, and said that she felt that she was able to be there. And I believe that her voice was the last voice that he heard, and I get comfort from that, and I hope that she did too.
I mean, it must have been a huge emotional toll on you and all your colleagues. How are you all coping now?
I think it has been, and that's certainly what I'm feeling at the moment. Is the kind of the burden on the people I work with, is that people are just exhausted. In the first wave, there was some energy. It was the start. It was novel. Whilst we were all terrified, we had this human inclination just to stick together and get through it. And we did. And the public appetite to support that was phenomenal as well. Fast forward 6 months, people are just drained. They're wiped out. But then obviously now we've moved into wave two and people are so, so tired. The workload obviously is ramped up again. It's constantly a struggle. It's constantly a struggle to get nurses, constantly a struggle to get cover with doctors. The hospitals are full. There are no beds anywhere. And it's just pressure. And people are worn out. And that, combined with this ongoing loss of life and human suffering, is hard. And personally speaking, and I'm sure I'm not alone in feeling this, is I'm quite fed up with being the person who's always devastating families' lives, as the person who has broken that bad news and with whom they will forever associate the day that their lives changed forever. And the worst part is they can't even see our faces. That we're just voices behind masks. And it's tough.
Julie Roach, you run Westbury Grange Care Home in Buckinghamshire.
Yes.
And very early on, it was clear that care homes were going to be at the heart of this crisis. And when we spoke in April, you told us this absolutely heartbreaking story. I was in tears every time I heard it back, about a family crowded around a window saying goodbye to their loved one.
They'd written cards, which they'd asked us to read, and that's very difficult, to read out a card from his wife. And she also brought perfume. She always wore the same perfume. So she bought some nice clean flannels and a bottle of the perfume and asked me to spray it on the flannel and just put it near him so as he could smell it. There was some acknowledgement there. He absolutely knew they were there. He was in bed. He was tucked up and nice and comfortable, and he wasn't in any distress or any pain. I stayed that night and stayed with him, and he slipped away just before midnight.
Have you had time to process all of that?
I think I'm getting emotional just listening to you talk about it.
Oh.
I think we have, partially maybe. I think it's just been a roller coaster, and March and April seems like, sometimes it seems like it was yesterday, and sometimes it feels like it was years ago. So I think we've partially dealt with it, but I think we haven't completely, because of the circumstances we're still working under. So, you know, we can have any amount of counselling and we can talk amongst ourselves about it and deal with it. I think we've parked it until we can actually meet up with these families and really get a proper closure on it.
And what about your staff, your team? I mean, they were putting in so much effort caring for the residents at that time and taking real risks yourselves. It was a huge emotional pressure and an unbelievable effort. How are they all doing now?
They are doing amazing. Through our real crisis back in March, April, beginning of May, they were amazing. They worked, I don't know how many hours, we supported one another. Once we started to come out of it and things started to stabilise slightly, I think we went through a period where we were all absolutely exhausted. That we went through a period of 2 or 3 weeks. We were tired, we were short-tempered. But we had counselling, and do you know, we've got past that. We're here because we want to do the job, and we love the job, and we love the home. So I've got a team that I am incredibly proud of.
How tough has it been not having family visits? What has that meant for residents?
Looking at them, I think they've managed so, so well. And again, I can't say enough about our relatives. They've been amazing and still are. And so patient, because it must be so difficult for them not to be able to come in and see their relatives and hug them and touch them and, you know, have that contact.
Especially at Christmas.
Oh, and even more so now, absolutely. And they're still being so, so supportive. But our residents, on the whole, have managed really well. We've kept that contact up. We've done window visits. We're getting a lovely piece of equipment, an interactive touch table. My admin manager did her usual incredible piece of work, put a Just Giving page up, and literally we were just blown away with the donations from anonymous people, from relatives. And this touch table is a 36-inch screen that you can do numerous activities on. You can also do the Zoom, the FaceTime, but you are looking at a screen almost that's life-size, which will be far better for our residents.
And when we last spoke, you were quite frustrated. You were frustrated about the advice care homes had been given, which seemed to be too little too late. And you were frustrated by the failures to test people who were being sent into homes.
Yeah.
Has that situation improved?
I think certainly the information we're getting now, yes, is much, much clearer. And with regards to the testing, of course, that is there now. We don't have anybody come in that isn't tested. And certainly with staff, you know, we're testing our staff weekly, and that's gone incredibly well, and I can't fault my staff on that. They're here every Sunday, Monday, without fail, laughing and joking, getting their test. And our residents, we've tested monthly.
And finally, things have changed, obviously, mm-hmm. in lots of ways that you've described. And yes. I heard you got a vaccine this morning.
I'm still in disbelief. I mean, obviously, we've heard it in the news and it was, you know, and we kept saying, oh, yeah, we'll get it. It'll be after Christmas. And then at 5:10 on Monday evening, I got a phone call from Milton Keynes Hospital, University Hospital, to say we're sending you out a link to an app and a spreadsheet. Please get your staff on it if they want it.
Boom. And what about your residents? Are they getting it?
Well, I'm sure that's in the pipeline, but I guess it's just the logistics of getting those vaccinations done. So, yes, I really hope that is going to happen soon, but we wait to hear.
Well, Julie, I'm so pleased to have a slightly more positive conversation with you, and my love to all your residents and to your
staff.
Thank
you. Oh, lovely. Thank you. It's very nice to talk to you again.
As we've been hearing from Laura and Julie, the COVID-19 pandemic was a public health crisis, stretching the NHS to its limit and devastating the lives of elderly people within the care sector. But it was also an economic disaster, plunging Britain into a recession that resulted in record numbers of people being made redundant. Paul Fryatt, when you spoke to my colleague Mithali in August, you'd just been laid off as a dental technician, and you were starting to look for work.
My wife's sort of written the CV out for me, and I'm starting to send my CV out to a few places, one of them being a supermarket, just in case I can just go and do some short-term work. And like I say, as of Monday, I'm not earning any money at all, so maybe just to pay some bills, but I'm a bit lost.
Tell me what that's been like. Have you had any luck or any promising leads?
No, I haven't. And it's been one of the most sort of frustrating things that I've ever had to sort of go through, really. It's out of everything. I had one interview at the co-op and they wrote back the next week telling me that I didn't make the grade, but that was about it. I've always worked since I was 16, since I left school, did my apprenticeship, and I'm 52 now, and I've never been out of a job. So when I came to being made redundant through COVID and having to look for work, it was impossible to find work within the dental community, really, in another dental lab, because of the way the government told dentists how to work at the moment. We've not seen patients, so I've had to look elsewhere.
So what have you been doing to get by financially?
I didn't sort of know that the instant that you made redundant, you had to claim universal credit straight away. Like, we waited something like 4 weeks just because of the fact that we'd had a baby, and I was given like a day's notice when I lost my job. There was like a lot of things going on, and by the time we got round to telling them, they were like quite abrupt and quite odd on the phone to say, why haven't you let us know? Like, you can't backdate your payments, and it's 6 weeks before they pay you anyway. And just the way they go about things, the way they deal with you, it's quite an inhuman way the system they put you through.
And so that process has been tough.
When you've got two children and you don't know really, like telling Alfie, you know, like we used to treat him quite a lot on weekends. He'd sometimes get like a little toy, you know, to sit him down and tell him that he wasn't going to be able to get anything anymore. Which he's
did
been,
you do that?
Yeah, he did, and he's been good because he's never asked for anything ever since, so he's like quite a good kid.
How old is he?
He's 7.
So what's Christmas going to be like at home?
Well, like, really difficult this year. We're not getting ourselves presents this year. Alfie's getting some presents. Like, my mum's been really good and helped us a bit, and we had some savings. It's been, I wouldn't say horrible, because there's a lot of people worse off. People are losing loved ones and things like that, so I wouldn't try to say we're in like a really terrible situation, but it's definitely the hardest Christmas that we'll have ever had.
Well, how does it feel for you? You've worked your whole life to suddenly be at home.
To be honest, I'm quite enjoying being at home. It's if it wasn't for the financial side of things, you know, I'm loving seeing my kids more, my children more, and I've got more than enough in my life to keep me entertained, you know. I'm back at college. I've enrolled on a course to try and to get into university next year, an access to health course, which I'm loving sort of being back and getting into education again. So that side of it's like excellent and superb, and spending more time with Nicola and the kids is a massive bonus.
One thing that politicians and the NHS didn't realise at the start of this crisis was that the risk of COVID-19 was not just to the patients who were hospitalised or those who lost their lives. There was another group who seemed to have milder cases, but somehow didn't seem to recover. And now the Office for National Statistics has said that one in five people may go on to suffer with long COVID. Yulia Hammond, we heard from you in the summer, and at that point, you were on day 138 of a headache. You had blurred vision and you were having difficulty breathing.
At the moment, the things that remain are the shortness of breath with what I've seen described by others as a python grip, which feels like there's a band around my rib cage, my lower rib cage, which doesn't allow me to expand my chest as well as I should.
Like so many doctors, you contracted COVID-19 this year, but what came in the months after sounded horrible and you were unable to work as a result. How are you feeling now?
So I'm back at work.
Good news.
Most of my symptoms have now resolved, except for the breathlessness, and occasionally I still have quite severely the python grip. So on the worst days, it just feels as though I can't expand my chest properly to breathe.
In what sort of situation would you have that?
Nowadays, it happens mostly, you know, after a long day at work, say, obviously wearing the masks doesn't help with the breathing. And so if I feel that I've done a significant amount of exertion or my breathing doesn't feel particularly good that day, then it seems to be worse at those times.
Gosh. And how terrible has this experience been for you overall?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't been easy. But I think I really wanted to sort of do this podcast because it's important for people to hear. I feel that my story is a success story, and I feel that I am well on the way to recovery. I would say I'm about 75% of normal at this point. I'm walking much more than I was before. So I basically undertook my own respiratory rehabilitation program. And so I started, you know, in the early days, I was only able to walk sort of 900 steps. And now, you know, I can walk, you know, 24,000 steps without really having to think about it. So it's a significant, significant improvement. But I think the following bits of recovery will probably take quite a long time. And so I sort of came to the point where I thought, you know, I'm able to work again. And so just for my own sort of mental health and self-worth, really, I think, I really felt that it was important for me to get back to work.
Let me ask you about your work as a doctor, because that's how you contracted it. And one of the things you talked about was not having adequate PPE. How frustrated are you that that's how you ended up with this disease, and have those issues been fixed?
So I think I'm really fortunate to work in a trust where PPE is being taken quite seriously, and patients are now wearing PPE as well. And so I think, you know, I think we can always do better at PPE. I mean, in my ideal world, the type of hazmat suits, you know, that you see sort of Ebola workers wearing is what all health workers would be wearing. Given what I've been through, I think that's what, you know, I would have liked to have had at the beginning. I'm not really angry so much about things. And I think at the moment, there is a lot of hope with the vaccine. In fact, I've just had the first dose of the Pfizer vaccine this morning.
You have?
I have, yes.
You're our second person who's had it. You know, at the beginning of this, we were hearing talk about how COVID disproportionately affected the elderly, and even at one point the suggestion that you could just isolate the elderly and that it wasn't really a worry for younger people. And even now, even though we know more about long COVID, there is a sense that, you know, once the vulnerable are protected, then life can go back to normal. Given what you've been through, how damaging do you think this disease can be for younger people?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think it can affect anybody in a variety of ways. And I think that's one of the issues that we'll be dealing with for quite a long time with this virus, because it doesn't seem to take any heed of age or even necessarily risk factors. So, you know, we have some friends and their father, who is, you know, in his late 60s, early 70s, was in ICU for weeks and was discharged. And within about a week and a half, he was back doing the shopping, the weekly shop. And whereas for me, you know, I couldn't hope to do that for months and months. And I had a so-called milder case and was never hospitalized. And so it's difficult to know. And I think there are young people, you know, who have died of the virus. And so I think it's not as clear-cut as we thought it was.
Coming up, an unexpected consequence of our COVID coverage this year. I speak to one of our blind date couples.
Hi there, I'm James Graham, writer of We Begin Again, a musical for 2020. It's a special partnership between The Guardian and the National Theatre that takes stock of this extraordinary year gone by and encourages everyone to reset for the year ahead. While many theatres have been in lockdown this year, we bring this timely performance straight to you, and I really hope you will all sway along at home. The video and single track can be found at www.theguardian.com/we-begin-again. Hope you enjoy it.
I don't know if you can hear that, but like there's a really big thunderstorm starting now.
He was really lovely looking. Dark hair, dark eyes, lovely smile. Yeah, a really, really lovely face.
In May, we wanted to explore how people were dating during lockdown. So our producer, Hannah Moore, set up several pairs on a blind date Zoom, including Deej and Naomi.
Deej, I think we're soulmates.
I think quite early on during the conversation, she replied to something I said with, "Does this mean we're soulmates?"
Yeah. Is it too soon to say?
Which was quite a forward.
It's been more than 7 months since your blind date, and now we are together on Zoom, and you guys are very much sitting together. So I'm guessing things have gone well.
Yeah, in a way, I guess things have been moving quite quickly since we first met 6-7 months ago when I came back from Kathmandu. We kind of decided that we would be in each other's bubbles because I live here with my flatmate, Kerry. Naomi lives at home, lives by herself in Old Street. So for pretty much the whole 6 months, we've been seeing each other either here or at her place.
Yeah, we talked about this the other day. Like, it has been a bit of a roller coaster. Like, we've both been through quite a lot in a short amount of time when nothing is really happening. But it's been amazing to have each other for support.
You're not just best friends. I'm assuming that this is a romantic thing.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely a romantic thing. I don't know how much detail you want me to go into.
Obviously. This is a family podcast, yeah. How did it feel listening back to your date when it was broadcast on Today in Focus?
It was really interesting to hear back myself in a date situation, especially the whole the rating situation. So Naomi rated me 10 out of 10 and I rated her...
Obviously.
8 out of 10.
How did you feel about that, Naomi?
I just couldn't believe what I'd done wrong, so, you know, within an hour and 45 minutes.
I listened to the podcast and immediately after I sent her a voice note explaining my 8 out of 10
rating.
I don't know why I said 8 really, because there was nothing to complain about. It was a perfect date. I think I'm a little bit funny when it comes to rating stuff. I don't think I really give anything a 10.
Have you pushed that grade up yet?
Yes, yes. So I upgraded it to 9.5 out of 10.
And anyway, Daniel told me that he never gives anything a 10 out of 10. However, I found out last night that actually he does rate his grandma's Christmas dinner 10 out of 10. So,
pretty good.
I was just keep going.
You've obviously been keeping in touch with our producer, Hannah, who set you up on the blind date. And you sent this video from your walk in the park.
Hey, Hannah. We have finally met up for the first time. And I think it's a really good sign that obviously there's thunder and lightning at the moment as well. So happy days. Thank you so much for introducing us. We're having a great time. 10 out of 10 date, this one.
How long was that after the date?
That was, so we had our date on the 18th of April and we met on the 6th of June.
It's pretty impressive when you remember the exact dates.
Well, they're quite symbolic, sorry. And I know that sounds really cheesy and I haven't remembered them because they mean loads. It's just milestones in my mind. Anyway.
Was he what you expected him to be like?
I was just so... couldn't believe that I hadn't actually met anybody, especially in the circumstances. And when Deej opened the door, I was just like, yeah, you were so much taller than I expected. And ganglier.
You asked for tall and handsome, didn't you?
I did. Tall, handsome and gangly. Yeah, I did. It did feel really natural from the beginning.
What about you, Deej? Was she everything you expected?
Yeah, again, like similar answer in that I didn't really know what to expect too much.
Apparently you asked for someone petite.
Did you? Tell me that.
Well, the first, like... 10-20 things I traits or whatever I said I liked was more to do with personality and stuff. And then
has it been difficult as well? Have you had challenges?
Yeah. Like in the last 6 months, massively. For example, Deej broke his hand at the beginning of September, so he couldn't really do any work, he couldn't really do any exercise, and that didn't take you to a good place, did it?
Yeah, and obviously that healing process took a while. So like the first month, 2 months of that, it got me quite down, to be honest.
And of course, I took it upon myself to become a full-time carer so that you thought you couldn't live without me, which I don't know if it worked or not, but anyway.
Have you had difficult times, Naomi?
A couple of very unfortunate things happened, like my dad was diagnosed with cancer in September.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Thank you. He's going to be okay, though.
Oh, good.
But that was horrible and a shock, but Deej was really supportive. But then my brand new baby nephew, who was born in Brisbane in August, who we were all dying to meet but haven't been able to yet, he was diagnosed with leukemia in November.
Oh, gosh.
Like 2 weeks after my dad's surgery. The last few weeks have been so difficult and he's been unbelievable.
So what are you? Are you boyfriend and girlfriend?
No! Don't.
So the thing with that is because I'm probably going away to India in like February or March next year, from the beginning we said we're not going to put a label on this. You know, we're just going to enjoy it and then it's going to finish, you know, when I leave.
Going into getting to know someone, knowing that they're not going to be around for very long was really hard for me because I was having all these thoughts and feelings and I wasn't really sure if I was allowed to have them. We kind of been working through that, I guess.
Why are you going to India?
I'm half Indian and I make a lot of environmental documentaries and stuff. So there's a whole bunch that I'm going to be making. I don't know how long I'm going to be there quite yet, but in my head, it was always going to be like a year long project. So yeah, I think we're trying not to put a label on it. We're trying just to, whether this is a good or a bad thing, I don't know. Because obviously when the time comes, it's going to be difficult. We both know that for sure. But, you know, we'll see what happens and who knows what's going to happen after that.
You two look loved up enough to survive a year in India, honestly.
We'll see. It's okay, though. I've finally made peace with it. I even read a proposal a couple of nights ago for India documentary stuff. I really do feel like what will be will be.
Well, let me just ask you two final tiny things then. If you could go back to January the 1st of this year and see yourself today, would you be surprised?
2020 has been such a ridiculous year for everybody. So it's hard to imagine that I'd be where I am now. But yeah, I think I would be surprised. I've been single for 3.5 years. So it kind of got to the point where I felt like no one was really catching my eye. And that has definitely... That has definitely changed now.
Yeah. I just can't imagine how things would have been if the last 6 months had been the same as the first 3 months, which were so challenging for me. And I was really ill for a good 3 months. So I feel like this has had a big part to play in me doing a lot better.
Well, it seems like complicated happiness in the middle of a dark year. So you've made us very, very happy. And I wish you both massive luck with whatever you decide to do. And I feel a bit like the old Indian auntie here. But honestly, a year's nothing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you to you and thank you to the team for putting us together. Like, yeah, you did a great job.
That was Kathleen, Laura, Julie, Paul, Yulia, Deej and Naomi. A huge thanks to all of them for speaking to us earlier in the year and for updating us for this episode. Now, before we go, I want to talk to you about the Guardian and Observer's charity appeal. We know that everyone's lives have been disrupted by coronavirus this year, but especially children and young people, especially those from poorer families. Whether it's school closures, the exams fiasco, a lack of jobs, cramped living conditions in a lockdown that banned socialising or playing sport, many have struggled with their mental health. This year, our appeal is asking readers and listeners to help raise money for charities devoted to children and young people, UK Youth, Young Minds and the Child Poverty Action Group. Please consider donating. You can do so today at theguardian.com/charityappeal2020. Many thanks. That is it for today. This episode was a huge team effort produced by Courtney Youssef, Elizabeth Cassin, Hannah Moore, Mithali Rao and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.